to these latest world news headlines.
Hello, I'm Steve Miller. The death toll from Typhoon Hato has risen to at least 12. It's the most powerful storm to hit the region in about 50 years. Chan Chi-ping, a spokesman from Macau Special Administrative Region in the government, details some of the incidents that happened on Macau.
Five people were killed and 153 others were injured as Typhoon Hato hit Macau. The government departments have been closely watching its impacts on Macau. Related departments have done and are continuing doing their parts and trying their best to handle rescue work and relief.
New information from Macau puts the death toll at 8 as Hato heads to China's Guangxi region. Voters in Angola are waiting to learn who will be the first president in decades following the retirement of President José Eduardo dos Santos. Votes are being counted to determine if dos Santos' likely successor, Defense Minister João Lourenço, will prevail. The ruling MPLA party is widely predicted to win Wednesday's election. China's government has criticized a U.S. decision to launch a trade probe of Beijing's technology policy as a violation of the global trading system and said it will resolutely defend any Chinese companies that are hurt. Commerce Ministry spokesman said the probe announced by U.S. Trade Representative Robert Lighthizer improperly applies U.S. law instead of international rules of trade. This is VOA News. A Spanish man is detained by Dutch police after he was found driving a van with gas canisters near a Rotterdam concert venue. Ryan Brooks has more on this story.
A possible attack on a concert in the Netherlands thwarted on Wednesday, police arresting a man driving a van loaded with gas canisters near Rotterdam. According to the city's mayor, authorities were led to the suspect after a tip-off from Spain about a threat to a gig by California band A La La's.
The bus stood out because it drove up and down a few times with a Spanish license plate, and that was the reason why police pulled it over.
Bomb squads rifled through the vehicle to see if it was part of the threat. Sources tell Reuters there was no link to the attacks in Spain last week, but an investigation is ongoing. Police say they took the driver into custody for questioning and canceled the show just before doors opened. No injuries were reported, and for now, Dutch counterterrorism has not escalated the country's threat level.
That's reporter Ryan Brooks. U.S. Vice President Mike Pence said on Wednesday that the Trump administration will bring the full measure of American economic and diplomatic power to bear to deal with the crisis in Venezuela.
The past half century has seen so much of Latin America follow down the road of freedom and progress. Yet as we speak, Venezuela has gone in the opposite direction, toward dictatorship, not democracy.
Pence spoke to a crowd at the church in Doral, Florida, an enclave for Venezuelan immigrants in the U.S. Earlier, Pence met with 15 Venezuelan exiles in South Florida who told him more help is needed to restore democracy in the socialist regime. This week, Pence also traveled to Colombia, Argentina, Chile, and Panama to rally friends in the hemisphere, but had to switch to damage control in the region scarred by past U.S. invasions. Egyptian President Abdel Fattah al-Sisi met U.S. presidential adviser Jared Kushner on Wednesday after the United States decided to withhold millions of dollars in aid. Two U.S. sources familiar with the matter told Reuters news agency on Tuesday that Washington had decided to deny Egypt $95.7 million in aid and to deny a further $195 million because it had failed to make progress on respecting human rights and democracy. Several cities in North India are under a security lockdown ahead of a verdict in a rape trial involving a controversial and hugely popular spiritual leader. Tens of thousands of followers of self-titled Saint Dr. Gurmeet Ram Rahim Singh Ji Insan have gathered in the town of Panchkula, where the special court is set to announce its verdict on Friday. Police and paramilitary soldiers are on the scene, fearing violence if a
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good morning, Africa. Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voices of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 24th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Vote counting is underway in Wednesday's Angolan presidential election.
According to law, the final results must be announced at least on 6th of September 2017. Within less than 2 weeks, the National Electoral Commission must announce the final results.
That's veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaiva in Luanda. Liberia's president asked the legislature to consider a bill for smooth political transition and provide security for former presidents and vice presidents. School burnings are on the rise as a strike in Cameroon's English-speaking regions deepens, and the UN peacekeeping mission increases patrol in Bria, Central African Republic.
Priority number one is to provide security to civilians. And then we take measures like patrols to make sure that groups do not move around the city.
Vladimir Montero is MINUSCA spokesperson. Lawyers in South Africa prepare to file court papers to sue Mrs. Grace Mugabe. And armed groups in South Sudan have looted 24 medical facilities over the last 18 months. Those stories, plus our listener of the day, are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Vote counting is underway in Wednesday's Angolan presidential and parliamentary elections. Six candidates are competing to succeed longtime president Eduardo dos Santos, who decided not to seek re-election after 38 years in power. Veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaiva says preliminary results are expected by tomorrow, Friday. He says overall the voting process was smooth compared to previous elections.
In comparison with the last elections, the current elections, of course, were more peaceful, more well-prepared, and the process went smooth. Myself, I went to a polling station early morning this Wednesday. It took me less than 2 minutes to vote, and the process went smooth almost everywhere. There's no major claims. Apart from that, we are listening in the last couple of hours some violent incidents happening in the Central Island province, like the Wambo. According to some opposition parties' sources, the police allegedly took the ballot boxes without the presence of some delegates of the opposition parties. We are waiting for an official response on this claim from the opposition parties.
The Angola Constitutional Court says that any party that has any grievances about the election should feel free to come to the court and not to do it through the media. I know that UNITA and CASA CE have already complained against the Election Commission. Do you think if they went to the Constitutional Court, can they get a fair hearing?
It's quite difficult because this will be unprecedented. You know, the war is in the last hours. You have these claims from the opposition parties that a number of violent incidents happened in Central and South provinces at the police stations. So I'm not sure if the Constitutional Court will agree to have this kind of claims. Anyway, these claims will be only putting on the table after the final result. And there's some kind of bureaucratic process for these claims to go ahead. So we will see. The next days will be quite definitive to clarify what will be the real political climate after the elections. Only when the final and official results will be announced, we can have clear visions about what kind of a scenario we have in Angola right now.
When do you think, Mario, that the Angolan people are going to get provisional results, and when do you think the final results will be announced?
According to law, the final results must be announced at least on 6th of September 2017. Within less than 2 weeks, the National Electoral Commission must announce the final results. As you know, there are some kind of technical and logistical problems. Angola is a huge country. Some observers are not sure if they will really reach this date of 6th of September. We will see. And if we have these claims on violence in some polling stations in the central and south province, it will be quite difficult to reach. But anyway, the next days will be, as I said before, it will be very important to clarify the next developments of the political scenario in Angola.
Mario, thank you very much as usual. So nice to talk with you.
Thank you very much, Jay.
As veteran Angolan journalist Mario Alpaivai, he was speaking with me from the capital, Luanda. The United Nations peacekeeping mission in the Central African Republic, known as MINUSCA, this week increased its patrols in the town of Bria after recent fighting in the area between ex-Seleka and anti-Balaka groups. MINUSCA spokesperson Vladimir Montero talks to Ricky Stryak about the new fighting and long-term solutions to the ongoing violence.
Well, the situation in Bria deteriorated since last week as a result of clashes between anti-Balaka elements and SPFC faction. It started with an incident and then get worsened. That was last week, and the force and MINUSCA police could intervene and separate the belligerents, but also protect the IDP sites. And on Saturday, once again, the same groups, anti-Balaka and ex-Seleka, from FPRC clashed again. We don't know so far the number of casualties, but we had to take a stand. Between 5,000 and 6,000 women and children, basically, sought refuge in our camp, and we were able to control the situation. It's still tense. It's still tense because of the presence of anti-Balakas in the area, which was not the case in the past, but it's calm since Saturday afternoon.
How long will MINUSCA continue the increased patrols?
Well, the patrols were increased as the incident started. You know, our policy in Bria and elsewhere is protection of civilians. It's priority number one, is to provide security to civilians. And then we take measures like patrols to make sure that groups do not move around the city and fight in the city, which can have more impact on civilian people. So that's the measures we are taking in Bria currently. At the same time, there are some mediations, local authorities and MINUSCA backing them to see how to escalate the situation.
And what is MINUSCA's view, the number one obstacle to stopping violence in the long term?
Well, MINUSCA's view is based on the government and the president's policy, which is a political process in order to disarm armed groups. This is our policy, and we are backing all this process. We are encouraging groups to adhere to this important document. But at the same time, we, whenever it's possible, we use the force to make sure that the population, civilian population, are not affected by this cycle of violence.
That was Vladimir Montero, MINUSCA spokesperson. He was speaking to Ricky Stryak from Bangui. Liberian President Ellen Johnson Sirleaf has asked the national legislature to consider a bill that would make political transition smooth and also provide security for former presidents and vice presidents. While the president did not ask for immunity from prosecution for herself, she said other countries striving to consolidate their democracies have incorporated immunity provisions for their former presidents and vice presidents as encouragement for leaders not to perpetuate themselves in office. She said it will be up to the legislature to decide whether to include immunity in the bill. Topa Molba, a member of the House of Representatives, says he welcomes the bill, including immunity for former presidents and vice presidents.
The view is that there should be a procedure and what are the transitions to do from one government to another and what the upcoming president needs to do by law and what time the turnover note to be giving and everything had to be looked at by the legislature. And it should be by law. It's not just be verbally done. So around West Africa, we have seen that. And so we appreciate that she would be on her own to draft a bill and send to the legislature for consideration. We will look at it and also and pass on it. and that will be the law, and it will be on book. And next time, any president is turning over, that the procedure we will follow.
That bill also talks about, Mr. Representative, it talks about the need for a former president and former vice president to have an office space provided by the government, and also security for the former president or the vice president. What is the view so far? I know you are going to consider that, but what's your own view?
Well, my own view is Ghana former president, they're providing security and also office space that they can be able to get to them at any time. So for the reason we think it's not strained to West Africa, it will not be strained to all. So in my own view, and we'll try to talk to our colleagues, that indeed we have to look at that and take it into consideration. The great United States have the same thing. A former president to provide you security and also like to be able to recognize the services you have provided for the country. So we think that it should be doing the same thing in Liberia here.
In the bill, Representative, the president did not ask for former presidents or vice president to get immunity, but she alluded to it, saying that other countries have provided immunity to allow their leaders not to stay in power forever. But she said that whether that is inserted into the bill will be up to you, the members of the legislature. Let me ask you, Mr. Representative, do you think a former leader should get immunity?
Yeah, it depends on what. If in your office you are taking decisions and somebody want to prosecute for that, I will not support that. But in the line of corruptions and if anything at this morning, in that light, it's not different, it's criminal eye. But whereas you are serving a president and you make decisions, some people will take it that is affect them, that they had to prosecute for that, I will not support that. It's the office you occupy at that time. This is why we think we will look at in a totality.
So say, for example, President Sirleaf did something during her tenure as president. You would not support for her to be prosecuted for that?
No, I will not support that. But if a criminal, on our law, you are not immune and as a criminal or criminality. So for the way I'm serving as president, I make a decision, you want for me to be prosecuted for that, I will not support that.
Topa Mulba is a member of the House of Representatives of Liberia. You're speaking with me from the capital, Monrovia. You're listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Thursday, August 24th, and please send your comments and opinions to Daybreak Africa at voanews.com. Daybreak Africa time is 18 minutes past the hour. Lawyers in South Africa are set to file papers in court seeking permission to sue Zimbabwe First Lady Grace Mugabe, who allegedly assaulted South African model Gabriella Engels for socializing with Mrs. Mugabe's children. Willie Spears, attorney at the AFRI Forum representing Engels, says they expect to be granted permission by the South African courts to serve papers on President Robert Mugabe in Harare. Spears tells reporter Blessing Zulu that serving the papers on President Mugabe would ensure that Mrs. Mugabe also gets notice of the application.
We issued the papers in court. It will be served. We've got what we call in South Africa a sheriff. Is actually a messenger of court. The messenger of court will be sent to serve papers on our Minister of International Relations. That will happen within the next few days. But on the 19th of September, we will ask permission from the court to serve papers on the presidency in Harare so that Mrs. Mugabe also gets notice of the application. So the process on the 19th of September is actually an application in which we will ask the court for permission to sue Mrs. Mugabe. Yeah.
So the court is to make a determination?
Yes.
But Mr. Spies, do you have a leg to stand on, judging from the fact that Mrs. Mugabe was already granted this immunity?
Well, the papers that we are serving is our papers attacking the immunity that was granted. We say that it was granted unlawfully. Our legislation does not provide for that. and we are applying for a court order to set aside that immunity.
There were also some legal experts who were saying it's possible to actually go and file your papers in courts in Zimbabwe if there is no joy in South Africa. Is this something that you're also considering?
I'm very doubtful if we will pursue justice through a Zimbabwean court. We do not have lots of trust in the Zimbabwean legal system. To be honest, the legal system in Zimbabwe, from experience that we have, has been corrupted by the Mugabe regime. And I do not have lots of faith in that system. So we won't sue within Zimbabwe.
And lastly, there was another lady who we understand had a miscarriage, the waitress. Are you representing her now?
Not yet. We are trying to get in touch with her, but we are not yet. At the moment, we are only representing Ms. Engel.
That was Willie Spears, an attorney at AfriForum, speaking from Johannesburg, South Africa, with reporter Blessing Zulu of VOA Zimbabwe Service. At least half a dozen schools in Cameroon's two English-speaking regions have been burned in the past week. It is the latest sign of deepening tensions as the strike in those regions enters its 10th month. Moki Edwin Kinzeka reports from Yaoundé.
Continued arson attacks in Cameroon's English-speaking northwest have prompted calls for the creation of a self-defense militia. Parents argued in Bamenda after their children's school, the Baptist Comprehensive High School, was set ablaze August 13th. Some said it is no longer safe for their children. The burnings have continued. Residents say schools are being targeted for failing to respect the call to strike until all Anglophone activists are released from detention. Messages circulating on social media this month have called for businesses to close 3 out of every 5 working days. Wilfred Ndong is a government official in charge of basic education for the Northwest.
The forces of law cannot be in every school. Therefore, parents, we have advised them to form vigilante groups in the school so that they can help to secure the places for us. And in places where they can afford, let them light up the places. Some of these things happen because of the dark nature of the environment's concern.
Markets and government buildings have also been targeted this year in the Northwest and Southwest. No one has claimed responsibility. The government has condemned the vandalism and blamed it on militant separatist groups. Cameroon government spokesperson Issa Chiruma told VOA police discovered a cache of weapons and a bomb-making factory in the northwestern town of Mbengue earlier this month. He said 7 people were arrested, including a Cameroonian-born Belgian national who had smuggled his way into the country through Nigeria.
He admitted being a member of the Ambazonia and the main leader of the armed wing of the Liberation Movement of Southern Cameroon.
Ambazonia is the name proposed by separatist activists for the nation they would create. At least 60 people arrested in connection with the strike have been answering charges of attempting to destabilize the country and cause revolt before a military court in the capital. A black and white video released online in early August of 12 strike detainees in what appears to be a dark underground prison has further raised tensions. The government has declined to comment on the video, but the footage has been shared widely on social media in Cameroon. In it, the speakers compare their conditions of detention to concentration camps, but say they will gladly die if need be for the cause of independence for the two Anglophone regions. The statement shows the separatist agenda has eclipsed the original strikers' demands calls for reform by Anglophone teachers and lawyers to address what they said was the overbearing use of the French in the nation's education and legal systems. Cameroon is officially a bilingual country with Anglophones about 20% of the country's 23 million inhabitants. Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The head of the French medical group Doctors Without Borders says over the last 18 months, armed groups have looted 24 medical facilities, which the organization has set up to provide life-saving assistance to South Sudanese. As Nabil Biagio reports from Juba, the group's international president has appealed directly to South Sudan President Salva Kiir to stop the attacks on medical facilities.
MSF President Juan Leo says, "The sad truth is that rather than protecting medical facilities, the warring parties will often target them. After recently visiting Wauchuluk, where she saw a destroyed MSF facility up close, she told President Kiir that the looting and destruction of medical facilities in South Sudan has cost lives.
For me, it's really just, I would say, a reflection of the violence that is happening. And what it does as the biggest consequence, it's depriving people of access to healthcare when they need it the most."
Leo says MSF's medical facilities were also destroyed in places like Pibor, Lir, and Kodok. But the level of destruction she saw in Wauchuluk was devastating.
"We had to take a boat for half an hour, then we have to walk for half an hour. That was clear to me when I went there and walked through Wauchuluk, who's been completely burned down and looted. Our facility was a PHCC of 30 beds. It's completely gone."
Despite rampant insecurity across South Sudan, Leo says her organization has no plans to leave the country.
"MSF as an organization is deeply committed to stay and work here in South Sudan, to stand beside the civilian population and offer as much as we can. And people must be allowed to have access to healthcare and life-saving services and assistance."
Leo says medical facilities must be protected. She says the war has taken a devastating toll on the civilians in former Upper Nile State, many of whom suffer from trauma.
"When I was in the clinic in Abarok and I was in the clinic in Malakal, what was as well very, very striking is the fact that people have lost hope because they moved 4 times over the last few months and they started from scratch all over again with nothing. And then they have no perspective of anything positive to come."
Leo says the number of young South Sudanese men wanting to end their lives is on the rise, and so is the number of people seeking mental support. She says she hopes President Kiir and other government officials listen to her pleas.
"One of the things that I came and convey to everybody I met, and including at the highest level, was to say that MSF is committed to the people of South Sudan, and we're going to continue to do work inside the country and as well as to displace people. We have opened 7 other projects outside because people have fled the country. But the thing is, we ask for access, we ask for respect for where we work, for our mobile clinic, for the facilities where we have people, not for us, but for patients."
Leo says the lack of access to people in need is a big problem. She says MSF's clinic in Abroj, for example, is totally inaccessible by road due to insecurity. The government has repeatedly said it is committed to protecting aid workers and their assets, but the destruction and looting of medical facilities continues unabated in several parts of the country. For VOA News, I'm Nabil Biagio in Juba.
Briefly, before we leave you, a summary of African news. Vote counting is underway in Wednesday's Angolan presidential and parliamentary election. 6 candidates are competing to succeed longtime President Eduardo dos Santos, who decided not to seek re-election after 38 years in power. And that's it for this Thursday, August 24th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Ricky Stryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, I'm James Butt in Washington wishing you a good day.
Hello, this is Peter Clotty, host of Nightline Africa. Please join us every Saturday and Sunday at 16 and 18 hours UTC. Nightline Africa is VOA's Africa's weekend show that provides news, features, and entertainment news about Africa and the world. Tune in, you will be glad you did. I guarantee it.
Interested in deeper analysis of news and events in Africa? Then plan to join me, Douglas Impuga, on Reporters Roundtable every Thursday at 17:30 UTC. We'll have African journalists and expert guests discuss the topic at hand. We take a deeper look at important African news topics. So plan to be with us every Thursday at 17:30 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.
Hello there and welcome. Today is Thursday, August 24th. This is VOA's International Edition. I'm Lori London in Washington. Coming up, a new day, a new attitude from the president.
We are not defined by the color of our skin.
The latest on the investigation in Russia and possible ties to the Trump campaign. Americans are flocking to take a look at a very smelly flower. Also ahead, big news from pop star Taylor Swift. It's all on today's International Edition. President Donald Trump issued an appeal for a more unified nation during a speech Wednesday in Reno, Nevada, saying in remarks delivered to the National Convention of the American Legion, a wartime veterans group, that, quote, it's time to heal the wounds that divide us.
We are not defined by the color of our skin, the figure on our paycheck, or the party of our politics. We are defined by our shared humanity, by our citizenship in this magnificent nation, and by the love that fills our hearts.
Well, the remarks come one day after Trump used a divisive speech in Phoenix, Arizona, to lash out at the news media again for its coverage of his response to the deadly violence at a recent protest organized by neo-Nazis and white supremacists in Charlottesville, Virginia.
Here's what I said on Saturday. We're closely following the terrible events unfolding in Charlottesville, Virginia. This is me speaking. We condemn in the strongest possible terms this egregious display of hatred, bigotry, and violence. That's me speaking on Saturday, right after the event. So I'm condemning the strongest possible terms, egregious display, hatred, bigotry, and violence. Okay, I think you can't do much better, right?
Trump was broadly criticized for blaming both sides for the violence in which a 32-year-old Heather Heyer was killed when a man associated with the white nationalists plowed his car into a crowd of counter-protesters. Then on Wednesday, the president recapped his Phoenix appearance in a Twitter post criticizing the media. Well, President Trump would be required to notify U.S. lawmakers before creating a joint U.S.-Russia cybersecurity unit. An idea that's drawn criticism across the political spectrum under legislation advancing in Congress. The proposal, if it becomes law, would be the latest in a series of maneuvers by Congress that either limit the president's authority on Russia matters or rebuke his desire to warm relations with Moscow. This, as the special counsel investigating whether Russia interfered in the U.S. presidential election and possible collusion with Moscow and the Trump campaign. He wants to speak with current and former senior White House officials, according to the New York Times. Joining me now, criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice. Jack, what do you make of the investigation? Where is it heading at this point? What direction is it going?
If we look at what's going on right now, it appears that the Russians were trying at the very highest levels and in some ways at very low levels within the Trump campaign to reach in and motivate and manipulate this election cycle. We're hearing about a lot of that and what the Russians were trying to do. This really, I think, establishes just how seriously the Russians were at trying to step into a potential Trump campaign and, ideally, from their perspective, a Trump administration.
Okay, so do you think it went all the way up to the top? Do you think that there might have been contact where the president or then the candidate Trump would have possibly been aware of all of this?
Tough to say, but when you say to the top, we know absolutely that it was close to the top because we already know that back in June of 2016 that Paul Manafort, Donald Trump Jr., and Jared Kushner all sat down with Russian officials, those that were former intelligence, those that were former SVR, absolutely. So we know that those contacts went directly to those people. And I think it's a reasonable assumption that they wouldn't have done this in a void. They wouldn't have done this without Donald Trump actually knowing about it. So I think there is a very real possibility that there was a if not direct connection, a very indirect one.
And we've got a couple other developments. We've got apparently an FBI raid of a former campaign director, Paul Manafort's home files, something. That was sort of startling in something like this.
There was a morning raid of Paul Manafort's home. And they were looking for very specific documents. Remember, Paul Manafort was required to turn over a whole series of documents to the Bureau. The idea that the FBI then made a decision to go in and take them says something more about their willingness to go after Paul Manafort. This isn't just an idle investigation. This isn't just sitting back passively saying, I wonder what we can find. They're very specifically digging right now. And that says something about how aggressively they're doing it, but frankly, how thoroughly they're doing it.
It's interesting, too, because we're not really getting leaks from this particular part of the investigation, anything having to do with the special counsel. So obviously he's quite methodical and you know, this is under pretty good wraps.
I would say that if you're facing an investigation by Bob Mueller and his people, and these people are pros, you should be concerned. If you have something that you're hiding, something that you're concerned about, you should be concerned, because you're right. They are very thorough. They are very aggressive. And more importantly, they hold on very tightly to what they are doing. These people are pros.
Apparently, they also want to interview White House staffers. Do you think that that could actually mean the president himself?
It's possible. I'm sure that's going to take a little bit longer. I know there's a lot of people who want this investigation to heat up. But frankly, again, Bob Mueller and his people are very thorough when it comes to this. And so I think it'll take a while. Because of the thoroughness of this investigation, the benefit is that what the FBI can then do when they're interrogating or interviewing people is they can know when they are lying because they know what they knew at the time, even on innocuous stuff. And remember, if you lie to an FBI officer, it's a federal crime. So this could be very serious indeed, even if you're talking to relatively low or mid-level staffers at the White House.
In your professional opinion, where do you think this is all going? Do you think that this is still going to be a long, drawn-out process, or do you think that they are getting close to some sort of resolution here?
I think it's going to be a long, drawn-out process. I think that they are not in a hurry in this case. But what I do think is that this is different than what we saw during the Nixon administration. Nobody really knew how to deal with the Saturday Night Massacre. Everybody was shocked by the idea that if you fired this guy, what would happen to Archibald Cox? What would happen to the president? What would happen to the administration? The entire country, and more importantly, Congress is watching this issue. They're very conscious of it. And likely you're going to see a response from justice and others. So while the process may take some time, I think it's going to be thorough. And frankly, they're not going to make mistakes. When they have answers, they're going to be answers.
All right. Criminal defense attorney and former CIA officer Jack Rice, thanks so much. Here are some of the stories we're following at voanews.com. The tragic wake of Islamic State rule. China, Russia object to new U.S. sanctions linked to North Korea. The Trump government shutdown threat draws criticism and unnerves the markets. And a 103-year-old Cambodian woman becomes a U.S. citizen. Find expanded coverage of these stories and more at voanews.com and on our VOA mobile app. This is International Edition. Secretary of State Rex Tillerson says President Trump has empowered U.S. commanders to make decisions based on conditions on the ground in Afghanistan, and that this will alter the dynamics in the U.S.'s longest war. But as VOA's diplomatic correspondent Cindy Sain reports, he also acknowledges it may be a war the U.S. cannot win on the battlefield.
President Donald Trump's announcement of his Afghanistan strategy has won the strong support of his Secretary of State, Rex Tillerson, who says it will not be based on artificial timelines, but on conditions on the ground in Afghanistan.
The fighting will still be borne by the Afghan forces, by their military and their security forces. But we believe that we can turn the tide of what has been a losing battle over the last year and a half or so and at least stabilize the situation.
But Tillerson conceded that even this new focus may not yield an outright military victory, calling on the Taliban to come to the negotiating table.
I think the president was clear this entire effort is intended to put pressure on the Taliban to have the Taliban understand you will not win a battlefield victory. We may not win one, but neither will you.
Tillerson agreed with Trump that Afghanistan's complex problems can only be solved with a regional approach, including India and Pakistan. But he said Pakistan needs to change its approach to terrorists. Some analysts agree, including David Sedney, who spoke to VOA Urdu's View 360.
Pakistan must take affirmative steps to stop the Taliban leadership from meeting in Pakistan, to stop arms and ammunition and explosives from coming from Pakistan into Afghanistan. Pakistan now knows that it cannot wait out the United States.
William Goodfellow told View 360 he does not see a major change in U.S. strategy towards Afghanistan.
I think the reason they're adding more troops is because they're worried that the Taliban have the initiative, and American generals were saying, well, we have a stalemate. Well, we don't have a stalemate. The American side is losing, and I think adding more troops will try to bring back the situation where you actually have a stalemate and set the stage for a negotiated settlement.
A negotiated settlement would likely be a welcome outcome for many in war-weary Afghanistan. Cindy Sain, VOA News, the State Department.
Well, the world's worst-smelling flower has bloomed at the U.S. Botanic Garden in Washington. The stench of the corpse flower is often compared to the odor of rotting flesh or garbage. Each giant plant grows one large flower that only lasts up to a couple of days. VOA's Deborah Block went to the Botanic Garden to find out what the smell was all about.
It is hard to believe that something so intriguing could smell so bad.
Actually, quite beautiful, but smells horrible.
It's a really stink.
The flower sends out the stench at pulsating intervals. The interior temperature of the flower reaches 46 Celsius with heat that helps spread the smell.
The plant right now is emitting a fire hose of odor, and it's just filling the space and really smelling. If you get up into that flow, you really need a gas mask.
And the reason behind the stench?
It's all about its pollinators. Its pollinators are carrion beetles and flies, and they're attracted to rotting meat as their food source. So that's why the plant is trying to imitate that smell to bring them in.
The rare plant native to the tropical rainforest of Sumatra, Indonesia, can grow more than 3.5 meters high and live for 40 years. The corpse flower does not bloom often, and in fact, this 5-year-old plant is blossoming for the first time, which fascinated this 8-year-old boy who had done some research in advance.
I know it stinks badly, but I didn't know how much it stung.
This plant is the world's largest unbranched inflorescence, or a cluster of multiple flowers that looks like a single one. The U.S. Botanic Garden has over a dozen corpse flowers plants. Soon, two more of the plants will flower, making it the first time in North America that three corpse flowers have come out at about the same time. Simultaneous flowers are extremely rare because the blooms only happen when the plant has accumulated enough energy in their underground storage organs. To ensure that plants can continue to grow outside their native habitat in the botanical garden and elsewhere, a couple of holes were cut into this flowering plant to harvest the male and female pollen.
These are listed as vulnerable species, and learning how to propagate them in botanic gardens may be one of the ways that we can ensure to have this plant available for many more years to come, because its habitat is threatened in its native Sumatra.
Deborah Block, VOA News, Washington.
And you're listening to International Edition on VOA.
Hello, sports fans. This is Sonny Young of the Sunny Side of Sports. For detailed information about your favorite sports, visit our website, voaafrica.com. And if you want to chat with me and sports fans in Africa and all over the world, visit my Sunny Side of Sports Facebook page. there the sports talk never stops. So come on, join the action with the Sunny Side of Sports. Hi, this is Victor Beatty, Managing Editor of VOA News. Tune in to the Voice of America's newscasts every hour on the top of each hour, 24-7. Listen to our news and correspondent reports from around the world. VOA is your trusted source for news and information.
VOA's International Edition continues now as we turn to the latest on what's trending on social media. And for that, we're joined by Andrew Palchewski. Hey, Andrew, anything new happening?
There's always something new on social media. You know how it is.
Yes.
And it changes by the minute. And the thing that's new today might not be good news for Facebook.
Uh-oh.
Of course, Facebook is the juggernaut. 2 billion active users around the world. Largest social network in the world. But Facebook is starting to lose some younger users. According to a new study, monthly usage for 12 to 17-year-olds in the U.S. and the U.K. is starting to fall. And it's part of this group that actually is never really getting on Facebook. Instead of going to Facebook, these young people are going to Snapchat and Instagram because they tend to communicate more visually. Now, the interesting thing about that is that Facebook owns Instagram. So even if they're not getting on Facebook, they're getting on something owned by Facebook. So they're not too worried about that side of it. The problem comes with Snapchat, as we've talked about before as well. Snapchat and Facebook tend to be back and forth enemies. They tend to steal things from each other. They try to one-up each other with new features. So this could be potentially worrying for Facebook. If enough young people flee to Snapchat going forward, yes, Facebook has 2 billion monthly active users now, but as new people get on social networks, they may not be going to Facebook, so it may begin to shrink. So Facebook is, I'm sure, looking at this data, worrying a little bit. Snapchat is, I'm sure, rejoicing at this, hoping that more young people will get on there. But it does seem that the demographic trends are shifting as new generations get on social media.
Cool. Anything else?
Yes. Big story out of the entertainment world. In about 24 hours from now, we will have our first listen to Taylor Swift's new single off of her new album called Reputation, something that blew up social media as soon as she dropped this. She actually used social media to publish her album cover for this album and publish the information about her new single coming out. So that went all around social media. But what's even more fascinating than this going viral is what Taylor Swift did prior to this social media post. She deleted all of her previous social media content from Instagram, from Twitter, clean slate.
Incredible.
In order to start with this new album. Very interesting move, and it really speaks to how artists and entertainers these days are using social media, not just to publicize what they do, but really to make statements. This is not the first time I've seen an artist delete everything like this. Even sports stars have done this during, say, the playoffs, where they've deleted everything from their social media accounts.
Just to really get people focused and excited and ramped up.
And reset, too, to say, this is, you know, this is, I'm starting fresh, I'm starting new. Everything else that I posted on social media before is gone, and we're starting from a new point in our lives. So very interesting how Taylor Swift is using it in this case. Very interesting to note, too, that this new album that she's teasing does not come out till November 10th. It's, what is that, 3 months from now? So it's amazing that already there's this hype on social media, and that speaks to how social and digital media really build up that hype ahead of whether it's an album release or a movie release. It's not just tweeting out and saying, hey, I'm releasing an album next week. It's a whole months-long campaign on social media to draw attention to this. And so this is the first stage of that that we're starting to see from Taylor Swift, something that has become the norm in the entertainment industry. And not just having a sponsored hashtag, but having content for weeks, months long.
All right, Andrew, thank you so much. Follow him on Twitter at APAL and myself at Lori London, L-U-N-D-I-N. Well, a new film by Korean-American filmmaker Justin Chan called Gook explores the 1992 Los Angeles riots from an Asian-American perspective. As VOA's David Byrd tells us, Chan borrowed from his real-life experience as an 11-year-old in Paramount, California, when he wrote and made the film.
This year marks 25 years since the Los Angeles riots following the non-guilty verdicts of several police officers who had been videotaped beating a black motorist. Justin Chan was just 11 when the riots broke out in Los Angeles, and his father's shoe store in Paramount, just across the freeway from South Central LA, was looted during the riots. Chan used his family's experience when he wrote and directed Gook. The 36-year-old Korean-American says that he wanted to tell the story of the riots from an Asian-American perspective.
I gestated on it for, you know, five years or so. It was like a kick in the butt when I found out other people were actually going to get their films made. And I felt like, okay, well, this is the 25th anniversary of the riots. No time better than now.
Chan plays Eli, who, along with his brother Daniel, played by YouTube star David So, runs a shoe store. Most of their customers are black or Latino, which reflects their neighborhood's makeup. Many of the businesses along the dilapidated street are Korean-owned, including a bodega run by an old man played by Chan's real-life father. When an 11-year-old orphaned black girl named Camilla, played by breakout star Simone Baker, begins to hang around the shoe store, she and the brothers develop a friendship. The relationship deepens even as the city around the trio begins to be fractured by violence and anger. Chan says that Camilla being 11 and facing a time of crisis echoes his own experience in 1992.
You process it differently as an 11-year-old. I think you process it in a way that's much more immediate needs. So I just was thinking about things that directly affected me, like, am I going to move? Am I going to change schools and make new friends? Those are like the main core things that I was thinking about. But I watched the news and I saw the whole thing unfold. It was almost like watching a movie. And then it becomes this very personal thing when your dad picks up and leaves and you know that he went there.
The director says that he tried to show the impact of the riots from several points of view.
Not just my family side. You see it from both communities and also how the Hispanic community, what their role was. You know, you start to analyze everything and I started to analyze my experience as well. So if you notice, the main character, Camilla, she's 11 in the film. Right. And I was 11 when it happened. So, you know, that's not a coincidence.
Gook was shot in black and white with cinematography by Ante Chung. It won this year's Next Prize, awarded by audiences at the Sundance Film Festival. Gook is open in select theaters across the United States. In Washington, I'm David Byrd.
Well, a pop princess has issued a new single. VOA's Border Crossings host Larry London joins International Edition's Sarah Williams with all the details.
So today we're focusing on a singer named Pink, and she is outrageous, she's outspoken, and she's kind of a very talented, very in-your-face performer, singer who's had a lot of success with a number of hits over the years, So What?, and, you know, she had a big hit with Lady Marmalade about over 10 years ago, I guess, with Christina Aguilera and a number of other singers. And now she's back with a new album after a five-year hiatus. The last album that Pink has had out was 2012. So she's back with a new album, and as Pink would have it, she's releasing it on Friday the 13th.
Oh.
October the 13th. And her new album is called Beautiful Trauma. And she just put out a brand new song, which is rising up the charts very, very quickly. So we're going to check it out today. Here's Pink and a song called What About Us?
We are searchlights we can see in the dark. We are rockets pointed up at the stars.
What is the theme behind this new album and single?
Well, there isn't necessarily a theme behind the album, which we won't know until we see all the songs on the album, which don't come out until the album's released October 13th. But as far as the first song goes, it's a power ballad. All of Pink's songs, as she ages, and she's 37 now, seem to have more significance, more meaning. She used to sing about parties and fun stuff, and now, it's taking a little bit of a darker turn. Now she's a mom. She's got a 6-year-old daughter named Willow and a 1-year-old son whose name is Jameson, who was born a year ago with her husband, Carrie Hart, of the past 11 years. So she's kind of taken a more serious view towards what she writes and put out. Last year, she put out a country song that was nominated for several awards. But this year she's back now with the new pop song. I watched the video, which just came out, and a lot of it takes place on prison grounds. It's kind of interesting. There's a lot of prison scenes. There's the typical in the car driving around scenes. She's got a strange looking hairdo. I don't know. She's curled and put it in a bun on the top of her head. So, you know, it's an interesting video. I like the song. And I would also like to say congratulations a little bit early to Pink, who on this coming up Sunday will be the recipient of an award that has been given to Rihanna, Beyonce, Madonna, Britney, quite a few others. It's called the Michael Jackson Video Vanguard Award, which will be handed out at the MTV Video Music Award show in California this Sunday. And she's going to get it this year.
Sounds very impressive.
It is impressive. MTV says the award is handed out because Pink has been a trailblazer and made an impact on music, pop culture, fashion, and philanthropy. And she's scheduled to perform. And over her career, Pink has won 3 Grammys, 7 MTV Awards, and she was named the 2009 Billboard Pop Sound Artist of the Decade. And she always makes it to Forbes' richest, highest-paid celebrities. Even though she hasn't put anything out in a long time, she averages about $30 million a year. And she's been on the VH1 Greatest Artist of All Time. So she's obviously been around for a while. She just did a festival show in Berlin, Germany 2 weeks ago. She performed alongside of a good friend of hers, Alanis Morissette. And so with the new album, I'm sure that Pink will have a tour. It's been a while, but we'll be excited because she puts on great shows. She swings from a trapeze, from the ceiling. She, you know, does so many things and dances. When she was growing up, she was a gymnast. So she's very fit. And it's always fun to watch Pink in a concert. The new album is called Beautiful Trauma. And the new song is What About Us?
All right. Thanks a lot, Larry. That's Larry London. He's the host of VOA's Border Crossings.
What about us?
You've been listening to International Edition. That does it for today's show, but you can find us anytime at voanews.com. Thank you for joining us. Thanks to our director, Tracy Carter, and our engineer, Jimmy Cook. I'm Lori London in Washington. Have a great day.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
During his recent visit to Santiago, Vice President Mike Pence spoke warmly of the strategic partnership and valued friendship between the United States and Chile. Referring to Chile as a beacon of freedom in the Western Hemisphere, the Vice President hailed Chile's economic success as an example for other nations across Latin America to enact their own market-based reforms to spur growth and generate prosperity for their citizens. Noting that Chile's embrace of free markets ultimately gave rise to a free society overall, the Vice President also underscored the strong commercial relations between the United States and Chile. The two-way trade in goods between the countries in 2016 totaled over $20 billion, stemming in large part from the U.S.-Chile Free Trade Agreement signed in 2004 and resulting in a 260% increase in trade since that time. Chile is also the one country in Latin America that participates in the U.S. Visa Waiver Program. In addition, Chile is a valued partner of the United States in its role in promoting regional security, notably in Central America. In his press conference with Chilean President Michelle Bachelet, Vice President Pence also praised Chile for its support in the face of North Korea's provocative behavior and for its clear statements in promoting a stable and a nuclear-free North Korean peninsula. He urged Chile, however, to do even more to isolate North Korea and break all diplomatic and commercial ties to the rogue nation. Finally, Mr. Pence expressed gratitude for Chile's leadership in standing with the Venezuelan people and condemning the Maduro regime. He emphasized that the United States will continue to bring the full measure of its economic and diplomatic power to bear until democracy is restored in Venezuela. and he expressed confidence that working with all our allies across Latin America, we can achieve a peaceable solution to the crisis facing the Venezuelan people. The United States cherishes its friendship and strong ties with Chile. And because both countries recognize that freedom is the source of their prosperity and security, Vice President Pence predicted that the United States and Chile will continue to achieve great progress for our people and our hemisphere.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
This is Larry London with more of the world's biggest hits after this news update on VOA 1.
Hello.